Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 204, Buddhist Inner Sciences, Triniverses.
They always say about Buddhist texts that if you can understand the salutatory verses of the text, you can understand the whole thing. And actually, writers do that. You know, you don't write your introduction or your preface or until you finish the whole thing, then you go back and do that. Elsewhere, I have given a final analysis. It's another book he wrote, resolving the difficult points of each chapter of The Peerless Illuminating Lamp, the vast commentary on the magnificent community, King of Tantras, which itself declares the unique treasure of the Triniverse. Nowadays I call this, I have a new term, Triniverse. Why not? What's this universe stuff? Like, it's my one universe, it's the, our one universe, it's our like, no, Triniverse, it's three things. The discovery, why should we say triple universe all the time? It's the Triniverse. The discovery of the Supreme, we have tricycle, why can't we have Triniverse? Or Triverse, or Triverse even we could have. The discovery of the supreme siddhi, attainment. Siddhi means an attainment and a power, and that's why people like to keep the word siddhi, but I think I'll put attainment, by means of great bliss. But since I did not see a precise and detailed explanation of the words and meanings of this tantric commentary, I will clarify the actual meanings with these annotations. And then he goes through something about the language and then he talks about the title of Chandrakirti's commentary. He says, because it illuminates the profound meanings hidden in the root. He has notes on himself, on his annotations. So he's annotating, and then he also has notes on his annotating. Because it illuminates the profound meanings hidden in the root tantra like a lamp burning in the darkness, it is illuminating. Then the first verse of Chandrakirti's work, The Lamp, I pay homage to the intuition hero, Manjushri. Now, Manjushri, I think we have a Manjushri. Well, this is like a blue, dark blue Manjushri, yogic, tantric Manjushri. But it's like a Manjushri holding the sword of critical wisdom in this hand, which doesn't symbolize something martial, but it symbolizes the sword of analytic wisdom, critical wisdom that cuts through complexities and confusions and has a flaming, like a laser flaming tip usually. But usually it's orange colored. Manjushri, we have a bunch of Manjushris around here. And Manjushri, and it's very interesting, it's the Buddhist icon or archangel or something like that of wisdom, scientific wisdom, which is not an old, experienced graybeard. Of course, it is an ancient being, but he always is in form of a youth. Manju Kumara Bhuta is one of his things. Kumara Bhuta means the ever youthful. So the idea of critical wisdom is like breakthrough revolutionary wisdom of the critical youth, not the old, resigned, broken-down graybeard who's like seen many winters and knows where the groundhog is and whatever. That's not the image of wisdom in the scientific Buddhist tradition. It's Manjushri. And he's called intuition hero. That means that he is a heroic, enlightening being who his body is made of intuition, made of wisdom, which is a form of direct experiential wisdom, intuition. It's amusing in the Kantian sense of unmediated experience, experiential knowledge, not conceptually mediated subject-object knowledge. So I use it intuition for that. I think it's perfect. It connects with female intuition and connects with Kant's notion of a direct, unmediated cognition or knowledge. The god of speech, the bodhisattva, that's an enlightenment hero, the mighty soul. He talks about Manjushri. He's the Vak Ishvara, that is God of speech. And so then there's his, he, He says, I pay, then Tsongkhapa comments on that single verse. He says, I pay homage to the hearer. The green thing is supposed to be repeating the word, who is the actuality of non-dual intuition. That's the direct experience of melting by great bliss into the object of ultimate nature of reality, the clear light, void, relativity, indivisible. Filled with love for all the Buddhist discovery of relativity, actually. Thousands of years before beloved Albert the Beloved. Non-dual intuition. Filled with love for all sentient beings and abandoning all taint of abrasiveness, he is Manju Shri. Manju means gentle. Shri means glory. Having acquired the divine power of speech, he is the god of speech. Oriented towards fulfilling the ultimate purpose of others, he is a mighty soul. And he is a bodhisattva because he aims also for his own ultimate self-interest, which is unexcelled enlightenment. Then there's another commentary. Da, da, da. So that's his first, that's a very major verse. And then Tsongkhapa gives a lot of commentary. And he says, this verse shows both the expression of worship and the pledge to compose. That's a technical thing in any Sanskrit work, scientific treatise, a shastra, as they call it. There always has to be some kind of salutation to the people. Like if one wrote a book about physics, you'd have homage to Einstein, homage to Niels Bohr, homage to Heisenberg, homage to whoever, You would write like that, homage to Richard Feynman, You'd put a thing like that at the beginning, and then you would say, I promise to write this book in order to clarify this and this point, what you're trying to accomplish in it. That should be at the beginning of every book. The first of these is shown by the words from Lord up to I bow down, and the order there is different because the English order is not the same. Anyway, never mind. And whose own nature is the magnificence of the intuition of the non-dual communion. That's, of course, the Buddha state described the communion, the two things together. Calm means together, and then union of two together, the calm adds that. As stated in the union of all, sorry, Pope Francis. As stated in the union of all Buddhist tantras, this is another text. Vajra is called emptiness, that because it's Vajra's, the Vajra, or the diamond, the unbreakable, is called the infinite clear light energy. And sattva is just intuition itself. And sattva is the individual being who melts into that clear light and yet retains their sense of the bliss of that melting as their own individual soul continuum, you could say. Embodying the nature of those two, that one is known as Vajrasattva. In other words, he bows to the one who has attained by means of entering the state of uniform experience of both ultimate Vajra voidness, clear light, and the intuition hero, magic body, who bows, the author of the commentary, in what way with devotion of the three doors of body, speech, and mind. For what purpose? To show his commitment to clear obstacles to the writing and for the sake of generating faith in others. If you should ask what is the use of this bowing and the rest of the quote, Chandra says, I will explain. What is he explaining? As for possessing the magnificence of the intuition of non-dual union, he designates the means of expression by the name of the principal topic to be expressed. From the further tantra, this is the 18th chapter of the Guhya Samhita, considered a separate tantra, he gives a definition of what tantra is. Tantra is renowned as continuum. That continuum, that's what it actually means. It's a word that can also mean weaving, and it means like threads being woven into a pattern in a continuation of the threads. That continuum is of three types, differentiated in terms of basis, nature, and non-deprivation. As therefore their aspects, the nature continuum is the cause, the non-deprivation continuum is the fruition, that's the Buddhahood, and the basis continuum is called the esoteric art of accelerating evolution progress from a normal human individual embodiment, body-mind complex, to a Buddha, the weird body-mind complex of a Buddha. Those three, where actually body and mind are same consciously at every level. Those three comprise the meaning of tantra. This first part is very, very famous. Now, let me mention the history. Chandrakirti was the abbot of Nalanda, the great, one of the four main abbots. There was, if Columbia University had the quality of the great Buddhist monastic universities, there would be four presidents of the university, not one. And his job would not be fundraising directly only, as our presidents are, of our corporatized universities. But and thankful that they do it because of the way the society is. But the four presidents would be in the four gates. They would have little booths in the four gates, little houses, like those cops that you see at the doorway on 116th Street at Columbia, or in the Harvard Yard, you know, off Harvard Square. You see a little police box. Well, they'd be there, and the supposedly top, and they would be the top professors, the top scholars, top insightful, enlightened beings. Why? Because the only reason that university keeps its tax deduction, its support by the king and the council of assembly that kings always had in India, that there's those city-states, is that their sort of ultimate mission, their ideology, their inculcation of knowledge of reality, physical reality and psychological reality, and the ethic derived from an accurate knowledge of reality, etc., was defensible in debate rationally from any other version of reality. So anybody was free to come to that university, and if they defeated the top scholar because they had a different view of reality, like the materialist would come and say, no, there's no spirit, there's no future life, it's all materialism. If they could win the debate, then they would become the president of the university, and the university would adapt its curriculum to teach materialism. And so the president was supposed to be the top, have the top understanding, and also they taught law and medicine, engineering, art, all these things in that university. It wasn't just Dharma, what they call the inner science, the interior science, which was the supreme science in those days, psychology, in other words, transformational psychology especially, not necessarily abnormal psychology. In the tradition, it is said that when Buddha taught the universal vehicle, you know, the Mahayana sutras like Lotus Sutra, Prajnaparamita, Transcendent Wisdom Sutra, Flower Ornament Sutra, etc., Shakyamuni Buddha himself taught them. He said to his, at the same time as he taught them, he also taught the esoteric tantras. So there were two levels of esoteric. Even the Mahayana, he said, should be esoteric for about 400 years from my time, because the society is not ready for non-duality. It would be misunderstood in a wrong way. Either people would think, this is nirvana, then who needs nirvana? I'm miserable. So that's a stupid thing. I don't believe this guy. He's an idiot. He's happy here, but he must be demented, because this is like miserable. I'm going to die, and I'm sick, and I feel crappy. And so that'd be one way of misunderstanding it. And the other way of misunderstanding it is that, it's all nirvana, so I can do whatever I feel like, because that won't make any difference. Maybe I feel bad, but I guess really I'm not bad, so whatever I do, I can do. And the kings might have become very ruthless, for example, in the upper classes, by saying it's all nirvana, so who cares about the poor people? You know. So for 400 years, he wanted to establish the dualistic version of Buddhism, where nirvana is the thing you get to by withdrawing from the world of domination and competition and struggle and suffering and causing suffering, and you want to withdraw from that, and you want to find a pure escape state. And the initial escape is you join the faculties of the mendicant order, which became the roots of the universities, and you re-educate yourself to find out this freedom. And of course, you think of it dualistically, this can't be nirvana. Nirvana must be some wonderful thing that I'll find when I become enlightened. So that's the dualistic version, which still exists in Theravada countries. And they still think that nirvana is going to be like outside. It's like getting into the freezer department out of the icebox. And in his way, his strategy works. What they find when they get there is that the rigidity of the inner sense of self melts to enough of an extent that they can then begin to tolerate the possibility that if I really change my understanding, maybe I can experience all of this in a blissful manner, in which case the reason for my existence will be, the absolute reason for my existence will be to only help those who do not understand it, to realize they can experience all this in a blissful manner, and they don't have to suffer so much and harm other people and harm themselves and fight with the universe, which, of course, anyone with the common sense can realize, one individual versus everybody else, is a losing proposition. That was esoteric. In other words, the non-dual thing he kept, he said, don't teach Mahayana widely for 400 years. And someone will come with the word Naga in their name, and they will spread, they will recover my Mahayana text of my Mahayana teachings, and they will spread it. And in the tantric tradition, the esoteric within the esoteric is Tantra, because it's based on the non-duality of the Mahayana. And the Tantra, from that Nagarjuna's time, for 700 years, they say, was never published in any way, shape, or form. There were no texts. They memorized all these things, and they didn't have texts, and they didn't allow texts, and they didn't teach the monks this. Even the monks who were, although they had the monastic, dualistic, individual vehicle Buddhist vow, they also had Mahayana Buddhist magnificent non-dual philosophy or vision or meditation, but even they were not quite ready for Tantra. And so they kept it without publication. Now, in Chandrakirti's time, in 7th century, they're starting to have texts that are that now become a subject of study within the monastic university. So then the question of interpreting the text becomes a huge thing, and especially to take some of the more shocking statements and not literally. And so the whole first section here is about that thing called the six parameters. And the six parameters consists of what's called interpretable meaning, definitive meaning, literal meaning, symbolic meaning. You know, that's jargon. Symbolic meaning means jargon, you know, technical term meaning. And then intentional meaning, and non-intentional meaning. And these are categories from the exoteric philosophy, but used in a completely different way. For example, the same statement, because of the whole ambiguity, the twilight zone of the tantras, you know, the same expression can have an interpretable meaning way of understanding it, which is right for someone who's on the creation stage, for example. And it can have a definitive meaning understanding, which is right for someone on the perfection stage. It's the same statement. So it's like it allows for there being ambiguity in things, and people understand, and keeping it, rather than collapsing the interpretive one into just the real one is this only. No, both are just as real, depending on who needs what. And then the one thing that's really tricky that I love is the intentional and non-intentional. In the exoteric, the preferable is the non-intentional, meaning he's not indirectly leading you. He doesn't have an ulterior intention of what the teacher says. You just want to take it literally, but he says you want to understand directly what he says, and that's the best meaning. And if there's something with an implicit hint in it, it's sort of lesser good. It's almost like interpretable. It could be reinterpreted. Whereas in the esoteric level, the one where they don't, where the teacher doesn't directly say something, but creates like an intimation where the eager disciple, the very sharp-minded disciple, will understand it, but has to come to that understanding on their own, because it's only implicit, it's not directly stated to them, so it's not a matter of just accepting. It's a matter of ferreting out that meaning, which makes it more real for the person who gets it on their own. So he gets it out of the indirection, the artful indirection. I think that's really right, brilliant. I like that very much. And why is it the case? Of course, because this is the very deepest thing where people are being taught the art of surrender through bliss to the universe. It's the opposite. You know, people, Western things, oh, Tantra, oh, a bunch of sorcerers, and this is the sort of power way of grabbing enlightenment by force. And you can't grab enlightenment by force. You can't surrender by force. You can maybe force yourself to be like, give up something you think is so great and like become generous and be able to let go of things, which is very what people do. Like, even without Buddhism, people do that in culture. It's common sense, right? It's like make your will, you know, create your foundation for your fortune, for your multi-billions, for your hotel, your Trump Tower. Who give it away? Because you don't want to die with like worrying about how am I going to keep my building? Because then you're going to be fighting your death and have a horrible death. So people love to give their stuff away when they get to that point, or they should. And therefore, for example, among the transcendent virtues, generosity is primary. Because it's like you give a dollar to that beggar who maybe he's not really going to go buy a bun and a cup of coffee, he's going to go find some crack. But that's not your point. He asks you for a dollar. You have a dollar, you give him a dollar. And then it's a great privilege, a joy to let go of a dollar. So, you know, this is quite wonderful. So, you know, he gives the Nagarjuna and the six parameters, and he goes on and on about this interpretive thing. They're called the seven ornaments. And then he gives what are the different stages. You know, the first stage is the create. This is a different way of counting the five stages. The mantra body, That's the creation stage, which we've talked about, right? Where you develop, you repeat and repeat and repeat a certain contemplative program where you reconstruct your, you go through a process of dissolving your ordinary body and you arise in an extraordinary deity body and so forth, just imaginatively, and that's called mantra body. And then you, then the second of, he jumps straight to the mind objective. And the mind objective is the first part. It connects with what's called the speech isolation and is called the mind isolation, meaning the mind is isolated from any habitual perception of the ordinary world, of the misplacement of one's confidence in the material world as one ordinarily misperceives it. And mind objective is where the mind itself becomes your object and you realize, you go through this 8 stages of dissolution and you get the energies in the central channel, etc. I can't describe all of this today because I want to jump to over quite a bit, but I encourage people to read it if you're studying this, which we're supposedly trying to do, and you'll have many questions, no doubt. It's also very scholarly. The other thing that I myself was surprised in my 30s, you know, when I was a monk, I got a lot of initiations, but and you're expected to recite something, but you're not expected to study that until you finish your emptiness studies, your Madhyamaka studies. You're a big Madhyamaka scholar. They're supposed to do that. Then when you hit 30s or even 40s sometimes, if you're slow, then you can then start really learning about Tantra that you may have been initiated and you're just familiarizing yourself with it kind of, but you don't really know what it is. And then you find it's a huge study too. It isn't just you go run out and go in the jungle and be a yogi and a sadhu or something. There's a lot to learn about it. I was very surprised about that. It's a huge scientific literature. It has like what I call, they don't use that term, but I call tantric Abhidharma. Since Abhidharma among the three baskets, even at the Theravada level, is the scientific reorganizing of the Buddha's discourses, which are done in individual context to individual audiences to benefit the individual people at whatever stage they are, supposedly, because Buddha being a really sensitive and clairvoyant about the student's state of mind teacher. And so then the Abhidharma organizes it in a kind of scientific way for more in general use by people like a manual of different stages and this kind of thing. So the tantras have that just as well, tantric Abhidharma. And it's a huge literature anyway.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded during the ongoing Force for Good class series at a session at Tibet House US in New York City in 2016. To learn more about this ongoing class series inspired by the life works of Tibet's Dalai Lama and the writings of Daniel Goleman. In his book by the same name, Force for Good, please visit tibethouse.us to learn more. If you can't attend in person, live webinars are offered during the class's run, and past selections from classic Force for Good classes are available on the Tibet House US YouTube channel and as a part of the Tibet House US member archives. To watch these past episodes of Force for Good sessions with Robert Thurman and friends, please visit Tibet House US on YouTube. The Force for Good class series is intended for Buddhist and non-Buddhists looking to explore the rich tapestry of Buddhist philosophy Buddhist Inner Sciences, and Buddhist Yogic Philosophy. If you're inspired by this week's episode, be sure to look for other past episodes of the Bob Thurman podcast that use the title Inner Sciences or Buddhism 101. These podcast series are taken from classic teachings at Tibet House US and the Force for Good class series. Links to related episodes will be included in the podcast description. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including discounts on tuition at programs in New York City and at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa in Phoenicia, New York, please visit tibethouse.us. Your monthly support and subscription to this podcast helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzin Chogyal. To learn more about Tenzin Chogyal, visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with a reading of the writings of Lawrence Ferlinghetti by Gary Gock. Enjoy.
Basically, what is the subject-object realization? If you perceive any experience, even if it seems, you know, the point is, if you develop critical learning, the way I see that pillar distorts the pillar by my feeling that that pillar is reduced to my concept of that pillar, basically. It fits with my concept. It's a solid thing. It's holding up the building made of concrete. Forget about some physicists saying it's atoms and subatomic particles and who knows what it is at the quantum level. You know, it's a wave-particle paradox going on right there in the pillar. I hope the building doesn't fall while we're deciding the paradox. So I misperceive that pillar as if it were an absolute pillar in itself. And I'm not even aware that I do. I just think I'm seeing the pillar. But I don't, therefore, I don't really... My mind doesn't sort of permeate the pillar, like really sort of know its inner structure and its everything, you know, from every conceivable direction. The actual inexpressibility of that pillar. And the fact that in a way it and I are totally enfolded in a field of experience, which I'm not sure about either one of us, but I can sort of be the pillar and be myself. That's a deeper non-subject-object intuitive CAT scan sort of experience of the elusiveness of the pillar to any, you know, conceptual overlay of what is the pillar. Okay? I don't see it like that. So therefore, when I have that habit of the pillar, and I meditate, and I shut down my thinking, and I let that guy in the Zen Center whack me on the back, and I stay up, and I wake, and I stay all night, and I go through grueling things like this, and then finally, I can't hear my own thinking at all, and then boom, I have a breakthrough thing, and suddenly I just feel that I'm in space. I go down to that some layer level of that subtle mindish thing. And then I experience a vast space of white light, like, I saw God. I saw the white light. I'm going to impose an absoluteness on that as an object and think that's the place I can go after death. That's the place I can go after enlightenment. And I can become totally rigid dualist and then feel that this is worthless, this world. And who needs it? And I'm trapped in a really not very good condition. I can't cope with it. I can't help anybody else. I want to get away from it all. And you can see how you would take that habit, because that's where you take a big experience that seems like maybe what a definition of the absolute might be. And that's what we have. Look at 2010, 2001. Movies teach us a lot of things, right? Especially 2010, even more than 2001, right? Those guys are standing there on some asteroid or something, and they're looking up at this giant black stone, and it's like a really solid thing. and they go touch it and they destroy it and they're absorbed into it or something. It's like, that's absolute power, don't touch it. And it can create suns, but it's a solid thing. Like, that's like the pillar. And it has absoluteness. And so, you know, Russians, don't try to go skate on that and your little cyclopedial thing or you'll swallow you up. Even though it's a big black stone. Somehow, I think they're taking it out of the Kaaba, some sort of weird Islamic dualist theology or something, the big black stone. But we all read it, we see it intuitively like, oh yeah, that must be absolute. Because we're projecting that into everything we see. That's the fundamental misperception, misknowledge, or wrong knowing of everything, including the self, of course, internally, but every external thing too. So naturally you have an extraordinary altered experience, and you're going to invest that, your absolute reality instinct pattern will be, you know, projected into that space, and then you'll feel that's the only real stuff and this is all nothing. And then you'll become a little bit heartless person, actually. But you'll be thinking you're enlightened. And somebody else might think you were holy if you kind of like radiate a little white light or something. You can go around and make them give you a Rolls Royce or something. Or 10 Rolls Royces, some nonsense. Or be a Brahmin and let the untouchables like live in the sewer. You know? Seriously, it's a real problem. And Buddha's non-dualism is totally crushes it. True non-dualism. Not fake non-dualism. But true non-dualism. Where the relative is the absolute. And your wisdom of that knowledge is that everything is your compassion for the relative, for anybody who's not enjoying the relative as they should be, if they knew its true nature, that it's a potentially infinite energy everywhere. And their body, I mean, what are we really made of, all of us? Pure light, already. It's not we're going to become light when we get a light, we're made of light now. Just throw yourself into an electron accelerator. All your atoms and your meat-space body, throw it in there and see if they can find it. They'll find a Higgs boson maybe running around. There'll be a Higgs boson in there accounting for your sense of volume. Nonsense. That's all enfolded in dark energy and dark matter. They have no idea what it all is. Niels Bohr told them in 1926 it disappears under analysis. Just work on the levels where you can reach it at a meso level of the particle. You know. Once it goes to wave particle thing, speed of light, it's sort of everywhere, you know. That's clear light. Clear light is, when you hit, that's why clear light, that when you touch the clear light in the Book of the Dead thing, that's death. That is death, because then you're disconnected from the particular continuum of the meat space bodies, you see, because you're suddenly vast and infinite. But when you have never rehearsed being infinite or identifying with having a continuum and being consciously infinite, when you've never rehearsed that, you naturally feel like threatened, like, oh, what if I'm lost my normally well-defended little self with my toy store? They took it away from me. And my toys are my fingers even, not just the objects outside. And you're suddenly frightened, so you immediately try to conjure up a new one, and you attract it towards some bodily form. That's the normal bardo state, right? But if you come at it from a creation stage where your mind can put yourself in a body of Yamantaka, or a body of Vajrayogini, or a body of, you can create a body that can manage, you know, compassionately to deal with whatever it is. You can even face death, you know, confidently. Because there is no death. Because that infinite state is what all the relative states are made of. And then you can be skillfully, infinitely relative. And therefore, you can deal skillfully with your relatives, which is always trying. It's always a trying experience, I believe, normally. Yeah. Eva maya shuttam ekasmin samaye. You know, Bhagavan sarvatitakaya kaya bhakchita vajra yoshit pavi. I'll find it. It's here, coming soon. Coming soon. The big shock. Ta-da-da. Here it is. Thus did I hear on a singular occasion. You know, they always say, thus have I heard. You know, if you've read, you know, in Buddhist sutras, remember I'm always complaining about it? Because, you know, Thus have I heard at one time. Remember? Thus have I heard. And I even had one student of mine try, thus have I heard once upon a time. Fairy tale. Right? And have I heard, like, oh, I heard a rumor. Oh, I heard. Oh, what did I hear around town? What was going on? You know, not at all. Thus did I hear on a singular occasion, as Evamaya Shrutam Ekasmin Samaye. All Buddha sutras begin like that. It's the signal of authenticity of the sutra, of the Buddha's speech. Meaning, the singular occasion was a time when I was there with the Buddha. And it was especially singular because I was in the fields of the Buddha. And did I hear means I directly heard this. And then the word thus in English is actually, maybe I will, because I'd like to have a two-syllable thing to translate. Oh, thus did I hear. But it's not very good, because the Sanskrit is evam, and there's a big meaning for evam. Evam. Where A is the female wisdom and vam is the male, or va is the male compassion. Eva. And the sound at the end is the, which is called the bindu or the drop, is the union of the male and female. So the whole of the Dharma is in the Eva. So Eva is kind of a good name, you know, Eva. Eva, Eva. Anyway, thus did I hear. Now this is a shock, isn't it? Imagine not being esoteric. Thus did I hear on a singular occasion the Bhagavan. Now Bhagavan is name of Buddha, and as you know, some of you who know about Hindus, you know Bhagavan, they talk about God, the Hindus do later. But Bhagavan first occurs in Buddhist texts as the name of Buddha. And Bhaga means, on one level, it means fortune, it means a share, actually. Bhaga means like a share of something, you know. So Bhagavan is one who has a share, you know, in that sense of a fortune, like share of the lunch, share of dinner, share of whatever, the fortune. So Bhagavan is the fortunate one, it means really, or it means like the lucky one. But then what is the deepest meaning of it? Was dwelling in the blessed vaginas. Dun, da, da. And then there's a big argument whether it's plural or singular. Of the Vajra queens, when Vajra queens mean the female Buddha forms, and they're Vajra because they are wisdom, so therefore they're completely indivisible from the infinite energy of the clear light of the void. But they are the Vajra queens, and they are the icons of wisdom. And then of the all Tathagata body, speech, mind, heart, who is Vajradhara. And the heart, the reason they say heart, and you know, I showed you before things about central channel and all this, you know, where we, all of us, have kind of a spark of clear light, awareness, super subtle body, mind, is in the center of heart chakra, right? The way they have done it. So it isn't that the clear light is just the center of each person's heart chakra. But it's like that's from where each individual sentient being can have that infinite sense of expansion. And the death process is where the drops or the consciousness, endocrine consciousness substances come from brain and lower chakras and go up the two directions into central channel and go into this sort of locket place in the center of the central channel, in the center of the heart complex, which is the sixfold knot symbolized by the Star of David, you know, or the Shiva Shakti double triangle thing interconnected, you know. And that opens, and that opens naturally when people die involuntarily. That's where the soul, that's the soul, if you will, that's the soul drop. It's called the indestructible drop. It's called the Buddha nature. It's called all sorts of things. And Norm, the reason it's always been there like that. But the reason that we don't all know that, and we're not all Buddhas, is that we don't have any subjectivity from that level. When we get down toward that subjectivity, we have to go through a barrier of seeming unconsciousness, seeming nothingness, and seeming explosion into space, so to speak. And we think that's somehow destructive and dangerous, and we're terrified because we, even though we know we're not safe actually in these bodies, we know that. We know we're going to die, but we live in denial of it. We know that we can be run over. We know that we bang into things. We know that we stub our toes. We know that we get sick. We know that we're carrying this and that virus and whatever, you know, and that achiness and arthritis and sore thumbs, and as you're getting older and older, more and more things, you have to have spare parts, hearing aids, and what all. We know that. You can't really defend it. We know. But yet we feel at least we're defending the worst of it, right? You know what I mean? We haven't been lured into a weird room in a mansion and attacked by somebody yet. This life, We haven't been killed by ISIS. We haven't been smashed by a hand grenade or an IED in a military vehicle and had our legs blown off or something. You know what I mean? So at least we're better than that. But ultimately, we're going to give up our legs. Ultimately, we're going to be let go of it all. You know, in Tibet, they love, ultimately, they'll feed their meat space body to vultures as make a gift of it, you know. We might leave our body to science, but the trouble with leaving organs about to science is that, although the generosity, I think, will overweigh that, but the process of disengaging the subtle consciousness from the body, since they have to chop it all out right away, keep it warm, you know, keep it fresh, throw it in the icebox, you know, the organs and things, it's a little disruptive to the consciousness, trying to, like, deal with the central nervous system and kind of get out in a good direction to have suddenly be hacked up, you know. That is a little bit problem of it. But the gift of it is still wonderful. Anyway, so what is this, the vaginas? And I'm still not sure whether the vaginas and the vulva, I might just change this to the vulvas. Because you can't quite visualize. Then, you know, the dharmodaya, they call, you know, it's just symbolized by a triangle. And this triangle has the three points of the triangle. Is emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness. And it's sort of the void, the architecture of the clear light of the void, and therefore it's the source of life. Because the emptiness is the source of life. Emptiness is not the destruction of life. It's not nothingness. Emptiness is actually freedom. It's just a negation. Freedom is a negation. Salt-free, sugar-free, pain-free, you know, intrinsic reality-free. Those are negations. Self-free means selfless, same. So then it doesn't sound so scary if we say freedom. We could do that in English, so I do it sometimes in popular works. But they said emptiness, so you pick it, and it has a slightly jarring quality, and it should have that, because it should empty the world of all these falsely important absolutes with which we stick ourselves into our unmanageable situation of self versus the universe, which is the source of our suffering. And so emptiness is, you know, chosen for a real... Buddha was also a genius teacher, in addition to being an Einstein, and being a Niels Bohr, being a Heisenberg, being a Darwin, and beyond them all, actually, even thousands of years earlier. In addition to that, he was also a very skilled teacher. So I haven't decided whether vulva is better than vagina. I can't figure it out. But it's sort of connected, right, isn't it? In male chauvinist, misogynist societies, these parts of body are sort of complicated language. But in honor of Eve Ensler, I like to call it vagina, I must say. I do. I think that's wonderful, you know. Have you ever been to one of the vagina monologues? Any of you? Has anybody ever been to one? They're great fun, I think. I like them. So if they let me in, being like, whatever, non-trans. But in all these creation stages, you can, it's much cheaper than trans operations. but it takes a long time, long effort. Anyway, this is the initial thing. And then there's a wonderful thing where he has a great commentary quoted from another text after that. He talks a lot about this. He talks a lot about this avam. Why is it always avam? And A is the female. A, also the shape of the Sanskrit letter A, is like a triangle. A looks like a triangle. And vam is a sort of round thing. And he goes on and on like that. And bhaga, therefore. And so Bhagavan, you know, is... You know, and then here I'm using both the word fortune and vagina together. You see, bhaga, and I put like that, just to keep emphasizing that. And these are the glories, you know. As for the six fortunes in the union tantra, it's a tantra, divine power, beauty, glory, fame, intuitive wisdom, and perfect creativity. That is what his fortune is, the bhaga of the Buddha. Possessing means commanding those six things. The first of those means having abandoned all defilements and not depending on anyone else. As for the second, beauty means endowed with the signs and marks. The third, glory means that those desiring the perfections of cyclic life and nirvanic liberation, samsara and nirvana, rely on you. Fourth is fame, because you are the foundation of all good qualities and your renown spreads in all directions. And the fifth, intuitive wisdom, means without any interference or interruption at all times. And and it knows everything. Means knowledge, I should put here. I should put a knowledge. Without it, so that's the six things. And that's that glory and that wondrous greatness is connected to the vagina, which is the source of life. So here you have the death of male chauvinism in the esoteric thing, because ancient India is a very chauvinist society too. It was. And here it comes in the esoteric thing from thousands of years ago. And Westerners say only 1,000 or only 1,200 years because they have this thing and they don't respect Indian people, Asian people, and they say, oh, they made it up later, and then they pretended Buddha did it because they're a bunch of liars because they're Asiatics and they didn't like go to school, you know, and go to school in the Anglican church or something. I mean, they had such a chauvinist attitude about Indian people, not to mention male chauvinist thing. The conquerors did. If you look at how they talk about all of this. Here, from the Vajra Rosary Tantra, one important tantra, Evam. The A syllable is holy, so this is Evam. You see, these ones here are the mantra, which are the... why didn't it save it the way I saved it? Damn. Never mind. These are the mantra of... Evam maya shrutam ekasmin samaye bhagavan, etc. Ekasmin samaye bhagavan. So that's the Buddha, right? Bhagavan sarva tathagata. You see, each syllable has a special commentary. So this famous 40 verses is really interesting to read and to study. And in a way, in all of these things, even in that first verse, everything you can sort of teach, everything you can extract, kind of everything.
If you are not yet aware, poet, translator, painter, publisher Lawrence Ferlinghetti is the first poet read by millions in his own lifetime. He's also the founder of the first bookstore in America dedicated to paperbacks, City Lights, which pioneered the homey library atmosphere now used by chain book outlets. City Lights Publishing Company was a major vehicle for the Beats, made famous during the obscenity trial over a book by Allen Ginsberg, and continues to remain a contemporary, vital publishing house in America. A biography of Ferlinghetti is available by fellow poet Neely Cherkovsky. Lawrence Ferlinghetti writes, I was a navigator on an AKA troop transport with about 10,000 troops. When we were past Hawaii and headed for Japan, we found out that we weren't an attack force anymore. We were going to be an occupation force and didn't have to fight. So we went into a little town called Sasebo, about 3 hours from Nagasaki by train. We didn't know what atomic bombs were. No one did in those days. In the Navy, as in all other military establishments, they tell you just as much as you need to know to perform your part of a slaughter or whatever other murderous commands you've been given. We didn't know anything. We went ashore, and there was no one there. The whole town was boarded up. There wasn't a Japanese in sight. When we went over to Nagasaki, it was total devastation. It was like a landscape in hell. What was left of bodies had all been cleared away by the time we got there, which was about 7 weeks after the bomb had been dropped. It was acres of mud with bones and hair sticking up out of it. And as I've said before, it really made me an instant pacifist. Up to that time, I'd been a good American boy, in the Boy Scouts, etc. Nagasaki really woke me up. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.